You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by sigmasport.co.uk, the UK's leading road cycling store. Use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout to receive £10 off your next order of £50 or more.
Friend of the podcast, Paddy McGurk. I listen to the weekly pod wearing one of my free Peddler to Charm t-shirts I received as 40th birthday presents.
I'm Ana Vivas here from Boyacá, Colombia, and I am a huge fan of the cycling podcast because cycling is even more interesting with British accents.
This is Larry Grossman from Washington, D.C. It is 6 o'clock in the morning in our nation's capital. My two dogs are happy. Somehow they know there's a new cycling podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Voice of Cycling, Rob Hatch.
Hello.
And the face and hair of cycling, Daniel Freeb.
Oh dear, hello Rich.
I'm afraid we are not joined by Lionel Burney this week. I think he's still making his way back from the Trobro Leon in Brittany. He was delayed.
Bit of a Homeric return home, wasn't it? It seemed to take him about 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, he's still working his way slowly back towards Watford or those parts.
Yeah, has he still got a puncture or something?
He did ride the Sportif and he did really well, I think. Trainer Road Training, obviously, stood him in good stead for that. But we are going to hear a bit from Lionel. He's going to have a presence. We're going to hear the weekly news roundup. Over to you, Lionel.
First, the racing news then. In Belgium, Petter Vakoc of Etix Quickstep won the Brabants Appeal with a great late finish. Second was Enrico Gasparotto, who gave a taste of what was to come at the weekend. Just on Etix, they've had a funny old spring, coming up short in all the big classics, but cleaning up in the minor one-day races. They've won Le Samin with Nicky Terpstra, Scheldt Prijs with Marcel Kittel, and now Brabants Appeal, so crumbs of comfort there for Patrick Lefebvre. In northeastern France at the Grand Prix de Dinan, Britain's Dan McClay of Fortuneo Vital Concept pulled off an extraordinary sprint finish, coming from outside the top 10 with about 150 metres to go and weaving his way through everybody to win. If you haven't seen it, you can probably find the clip on Twitter. It's an extraordinary finish. In Spain at the Vuelta a Castilla y León, Colombian Carlos Betancourt won his first race since the 2014 Paris-Nice when he took the opening stage. His Movistar teammate Alejandro Valverde won the two other stages and the overall classification to show he's in perfect form as he tries to win his fourth Liège-Bastogne-Liège this weekend. On Sunday, I was at the Trobro Leon in Brittany, where the One Pro cycling team did the 1-2, with Dane Martin Mortensen winning ahead of his teammate Peter Williams. I'll have a dispatch from that race at some point in a future episode. Sunday's World Tour race was the Amstel Gold Race in the Netherlands, and that was won by Enrico Gasparotto, and he dedicated that victory to Antoine de Moitier, his Wanty Group Goubert teammate who died at Gent-Wevelgem earlier in the spring. Emma Johansson won the Euskal Bira stage race and a couple of stages in the Basque Country. And there's been a couple of controversies in professional cycling in the past week or so. It wouldn't be pro cycling without them. The use of disc brakes has become a hot topic after Movistar's Francisco Ventoso posted photos of injuries he says were sustained after hitting discs in a crash at Paris-Roubaix. The Spaniard wrote an open letter and the UCI has suspended the use of discs for the time being. We'll hear more from Richard and Daniel on that in this episode. And a joint investigation by French TV show Stade 2 and Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera alleges that motorised bikes were used at Strade Bianche and the Coppi e Bartali stage race. They say thermal camera footage proves that motorised cheating is going on in the peloton. Now, that's an issue we will no doubt tackle in greater depth in the coming weeks. But for now, that's all of the headlines. Back to Richard and Daniel.
So we heard there from Lionel. I think he was mid-tunnel as he gave us his weekly roundup there. Thank you for that, Lionel. So we've got Daniel's been doing something strange behind my back. What are you doing, Daniel? What are you doing?
I've just been watching you self-massage, Richard. Or are you massaging your ego?
My ego's not down there.
Well, since Rob Hatch is here, your bete noire in the recent Trainer Road Challenge, I brought one of our Wellbricks along. Wellbricks, of course, sponsor us in our Kilometre Zero Survivors of Spring series. A new episode has gone out this week, talking about a Monday after hell, the day after Paris-Roubaix. And we've got one of the Wellbricks here, and you're currently using it, Rich.
You've inserted it down behind my back, and it's resting there. And I'll just give myself a little massage while I'm doing the podcast. That's okay, isn't it? That's allowed. That's not on the WADA code or anything. I'm allowed to self-massage while delivering this podcast. So listen, we've got lots to talk about. Beyond that, we're going to talk about Amstel Gold Race, not the first of the Ardennes Classics, but certainly a transitional classic between the cobbled ones and the Ardennes Classics, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. This episode will come out after Flèche Wallonne, but we'll talk about that next week. It wasn't a great race. We're not going to spend too long on the Amstel Gold Race, I don't think. We're going to talk more about the latest controversies regarding disc brakes and alleged mechanical doping motors and bikes. We'll hear from Brent Copeland, the general manager at Lamprey Merida, later in this episode. But Amstel Gold Race, thoughts, chaps?
Well, Rob Hatch was there, so let's ask him.
Rob Hatch?
An eternal disappointment, I think. Every year I turn up and it's such a brilliantly organised race. Since it's moved down the road, it's a bit like the Tour of Flanders now. You've got all these fields where you can park, a load of VIPs, brilliant press room, superb start list, good atmosphere when you go to Maastricht in the morning, but nothing ever happens until the final 20 kilometres. Do we think it's too hard, chaps?
Funny one, isn't it? Because when the World Road Race Championship finished up the Kalberg a few years ago, it did produce a pretty exciting race. So what's the problem?
I think we need Lionel at this point, really, don't we? Because Lionel, well, it's a particular bugbear of his.
One of many.
Yeah, the Ardennes Classics. Fortunately, now they have moved the finish from the very top of the Kooiberg. It's about a couple of kilometres down the road. And the race has become a bit less predictable. But Lionel's bugbear has always been, and mine as well, that Flèche Wallonne and Amstel Gold, and to a lesser extent Liège, are almost the same race, and they're essentially an uphill sprint. In Amstel's case, up the Kooiberg; in Flèche's case, up the Mur de Huy. And really, everyone is terrified of attacking or doing anything bold until the bottom of the Kooiberg, and that's pretty much what we saw again. It kind of came to life in the last 10 kilometres. Tim Wellens launched a very good attack, but it was an uphill sprint. Essentially, it's, you know, one of the great redeeming features, if you like, about sprint finishes, or one of the great sources of interest with sprint finishes themselves, is the tactical element and how trains are organized and how teams set themselves up. And you know, we've talked a lot about that over the years with the likes of Mark Cavendish. With an uphill sprint, there's much less of a technical tactical element, isn't there? And consequently, they become quite boring, and Amstel is quite boring.
Yeah, I always find Brabant-Upale on the Wednesday before a more interesting race, actually. I don't know whether it's slightly easier. I don't know whether the hills are better spaced. The final three finishing laps might be a better proposition. I'm not quite sure. But when we get to Amstel, we get everybody turning up, these fantastic start lists, and we're thinking, well, Matthews, loads of people in the reckoning. And in the end, Gaspar Otto just hung around third.
I was wondering how long we could go discussing the Amstel Gold Race without mentioning the winner.
Well, it was that sort of race, unfortunately. And Gaspar Otto, it's not as if he was hidden the whole race. He was up there in the first 10 wheels. There was an air of predictability about it, and inevitability even, that it was either going to be him, Kreuziger, who was hanging around as well, or one of the Orica Green Edge lads who went out and got the win. I would say that it was the perfect race written by Gaspar Otto. Massive kudos to him and for his team, of course, and what it means to them 3 weeks after the death of Antoine de Moitier. He quite rightly dedicated that win to his fallen teammate. And it's funny, it was the first time that Gaspar Otto had won a bike race since Amstel Gold 4 years ago. So it's one that he knows how to ride well. And Brabant-Upale, as it usually does, gave us that indication as to who was on form, who wasn't. I think this year, Amstel was more notable for the riders who weren't on form. If you look going into the final lap, we came across the finish line with about 18, 19 kilometres to go. Kwiatkowski disappeared. Gilbert didn't have the legs, but we know that he'd been fighting and had a
bit. Or the finger.
Well, something like that, yeah. Rob Hales, co-commentator over in Amstel, suggested that it was his middle finger that had been injured and it had been ripped off by the driver.
Yeah, we should explain. Philippe Gilbert was involved in an altercation with a motorist, which is now going through the courts in Belgium, I think, so we probably shouldn't say too much about it. But he's alleged to have attacked his assailant with a pepper spray, something which every good professional rider must carry with him. Or her.
Talking of fairly sordid business, Gaspar Otto is someone whose reputation has suffered slightly by virtue of his association with Michele Ferrari, the infamous sports doctor. Never punished, never sanctioned for that, which is a little bit puzzling because, you know, we know that various riders were banned because Michele Ferrari is banned officially under the rules of the Italian Cycling Federation. So, likes of a friend of the podcast, it pains me to say it, but friends of the podcast, Filippo Pozzato got a 3-month ban a few years back for using the services of Michele Ferrari. And Gasparotto is someone who I've just looked it up on my computer, mentioned 9 times in the Indagine Mito, which is the Padova investigation into Michele Ferrari. 500 pages long, 9 mentions of Enrico Gasparotto. Nothing particularly incriminating, but seems fairly sure that the two are at least passing acquaintances.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Okay, you heard there our jingle for Eurosport. Thank you very much, Eurosport, for their sponsorship of the cycling podcast. Coming up on Eurosport, Tour of Croatia, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, live on Sunday, and the Tour of Turkey also starts on Sunday. Also, you will find our big race explainer. Lionel giving us a big race explainer includes some words from former winner Simon Gerrans. So that's all coming up on Eurosport. And we're going to move on to, I think, talk first. There are two sort of equipment-related stories that we want to address with the help of Brent Copeland, who Daniel spoke to a couple of days ago. Disc brakes, we'll talk about them in the next section. And mechanical doping is such a clumsy term, that, isn't it? But motors and bikes. There was a newspaper article on a TV program at the weekend in Italy and France on this story, a sort of joint investigation, which using sort of thermal heat sensors appeared to show some activity in bikes that could have been indicative of some kind of motors. Now, it seemed to me pretty inconclusive. They claim to have footage from Strada Bianchi and Coppi Bartali, 2 races in Italy, that appeared to show riders with this heat being generated in their bikes. Lots of debate about what might have caused that heat, whether indeed there was sufficient heat, because when we saw footage of amateurs riding Sportives, Gran Fondos, it seemed much more obvious that the heat being generated by motors that they were using. And it seemed pretty inconclusive to me. What did also strike me was that if this was a journalistic investigation and they were sure that there was this evidence of motors in bikes belonging to professional riders, why not go to the riders and the teams and put this evidence to them and get some kind of response from them? That's what you would normally do in that situation. So I'm not really clear about why that didn't happen. But Rob, you know, did you watch it? What are your thoughts on it?
My first thoughts came before the documentary was aired. I was in the press room at Amstel Gold on Sunday morning, and there were a couple of people from Italian television came up to me, two people who I really respect and who normally don't go waving their hands and jumping the gun and saying, oh, this is a big story.
Hang on, they're Italians.
Exactly. less Latin body language than the stereotype, but usually quite calm, well-respected people, and they were quite serious about this. Oh, big news. Have you seen the news this morning in Italy? Grande casino, they were saying. Big problems. What a mess. So I started having a look at it, and I went online to read this article that was in Corriere della Sera. The language in the article seemed to suggest to me straight away that they had red-hot proof, that there were 7 names, they were saying, in the Coppi Bartali and even Strade Bianche races that had been supposedly caught by this thermal imaging camera. And the rest was going to come out in Stade 2, this French investigation on French national public television. And we were all waiting for it. Then I went off to do the commentary, and I mentioned it to a couple of other journalists, sent a couple of text messages around and said, you know, keep your eyes out for this. Went and watched it, and I have to say that given the wording in the article early on in the day, I was quite disappointed with what I saw on the television. And I think I go back to your first point in that the journalistic integrity of this might not be all that it should have been.
Now, let's not be complacent. I think you're going to mention this, Daniel. The technology exists and it's going to get better and it's going to get harder to find. And so most of us, you know, there has been a motor found in a bike already for earlier this year in a cyclocross race. So absolutely it's not beyond the realms of possibility that this goes on. However, and we'll hear from Brent Copeland in a minute on this as well. I just, again, going back to the sort of integrity of the programme in particular, Stade, the lingering shots of Fabian Cancellara, Chris Froome, the implication that these guys were under suspicion, and Alberto Contador as well, that struck me as irresponsible.
Irresponsible, or hinting that there are people who know more about this story than they are letting on and are just waiting to pull the trigger, really, and whether they're going to release more and the bigger stories are going to come on the eve, for example, of the Giro d'Italia or the Tour de France. We've seen in the past that people tend to hold their big scoops back, and we ourselves perhaps on occasions hold our big scoops back for those, you know, the moments when the world is watching. So that is a possibility. But there are some odd things in the way this story and these stories have been reported up to now, which suggests to me that journalists are sitting on more information. For example, Contador is another rider who's been mentioned. Last year during the Giro d'Italia, Philippe Brunel, who's a very, very respected journalist for L'Equipe and has been writing on cycling for years and years and is not prone to jumping the gun on these things, he didn't use the conditional tense, he didn't use allegedly, he didn't use presumably. He pretty much outright accused Alberto Contador of having used a motor at some point in his career. Same with the Corriere on Sunday. Again, no conditional tense, no allegedlies. They said seven riders had been using motors in the Coppa Bartali. Also on the Corriere's website that day, there was a video posted with a title, a caption, "Here is how Alberto Contador won the Giro with a motor in his bike." A couple of hours later, and I've got screen grabs of this, a couple of hours later that had changed and they backtracked slightly, and it was couched in sort of more circumspect terms. However, these things, and again, the Corriere journalist in question, Marco Bonarigo, is not someone who's prone to sort of salacious tabloid-style journalism. So I just wonder whether there is a bomb that is about to drop and we have just not heard the damning proof and the damning evidence yet, but it does exist.
My impression, if that is the case, is that it's not something that's going on in a widespread way throughout the peloton, because speaking to riders and directors and so on, you know, I think you can generally tell whether they regard it as a serious threat at all. The language, the body language, the tone, everything about the conversation around motors and bikes with most riders, they seem as astonished as anybody else that this could be happening. So if it is happening, I suspect it's happening in a very limited but no less devastating way, if that's the case. You know, I think we should probably hear from Brent Copeland, because I think he was interesting. He's the general manager at Lampre Merida, and I think what he says about, in particular, the role in this of the bike sponsors, who, in a sport that's struggling to attract outside sponsorship, is increasingly dependent on the bike industry for sponsorship. I think that, you know, a motorised doping scandal that would implicate a major bike manufacturer would be absolutely disastrous.
Well, and also just before we hear from Brent, he does make the point that people have been dubious about the UCI's role and whether they're doing enough and whether they're pretending to do enough, being seen to do enough, but actually are not really interested in investigating this matter fully. Brent makes the point that this is a bigger disaster. This would be a bigger disaster for the UCI than for anyone. And why they would be soft pedaling, so to speak, on this, it is slightly unfathomable, really.
I don't think it's very clear, the article. I saw bits and pieces of it. I was up in Amstel, so I haven't got to see the production that the French TV put together. I saw a bit of the article. But it's not very clear to me because, firstly, they don't name any names of teams or riders who's using it. And secondly, I just don't see why the UCI wouldn't want to catch someone that's doing mechanical doping. I don't see a rider risking so much or a team risking so much. You know, biological doping, you can understand if a rider's going to risk it on his own. It's only him involved. Unfortunately, there's a lot of riders out there that are ignorant enough to try this. Mechanical doping is a different ballgame. You've got to get the mechanics involved, you've got to get the team involved, you've got to get the manufacturers involved. And it's just too risky. I just don't see it happening. The UCI have gone out of their way to do all the testing that they can do. The way they've been testing seems legitimate to me. What I've seen them do at the races, and they're doing it continuously before, after. In the beginning, they were taking the bikes to pieces. So taking the bike to pieces, more than that, they can't really do much. That stopped because it just became logistically too much to handle for the mechanics. They brought out this new method of testing. Seems to be working. They guarantee that it works. I don't see why they would lie about it. So it's very unclear to me why the Corriere della Sera would be out of the way to try prove them wrong. And until we physically see the truth of it, then, you know, I'm not going to believe that it's actually happening in the group. I would like to believe that it's definitely not happening in the group, that's for sure. It would be a terrible disaster if it is. And I just, you know, some of the images I saw, the hubs are heated up, and I don't know, I just think to myself, surely a hub heats up in any case if you're riding it to up a climb or down on a flat road. But to prove that there's a motor in there, I guess, is difficult.
So Brent Copeland there, general manager at Lampre Merida, very interesting on the topic of motors and bikes. Daniel, you were going to say something else?
Well, just on the programme itself, Stade d'Or, there was an interview with István Vargas, I think you pronounce his name. He is a Hungarian gentleman, the inventor of certainly one of the mechanisms that has allegedly been used, or it could allegedly be used by professional riders. And he is a former rider himself. I don't really know at what level. I think he raced at some level. And he explains that the reason he came up with this mechanism, motorized cycling in effect, was that he wanted to provide a means of cycling to people who had had terrible injuries in the Balkan Wars, maybe amputees, or even now people with heart problems, etc. And this poses interesting philosophical moral questions, in the sense that the WADA list specifies that there should be three criteria for banning substances. One of the criteria is that they should damage people's health, and they should pose a risk to someone's health. Well, obviously, if we're talking about mechanisms and motors that have been developed effectively to enhance people's life when they do have health problems, then I think, you know, just leave that hanging. That does pose an interesting philosophical question. But this gentleman, István Vargas, certainly makes a very compelling, well, the next perhaps compelling cartoon villain in the professional peloton, and in the sort of cycling landscape, in the sense he's someone who talks with a bit of a glint in his eye. He suggests that he's very much against people using motors in races. He says, you know, you wouldn't blame the inventor of a bread knife if a bread knife was then used to murder someone. He likens his role in this whole saga to that. He's just invented it, and if someone else is using it to dope and to cheat, then that's not his problem. But you know, there are allegations that Vincent Watley, Philippe Gilbert's agent, has come out in the Belgian press today and said that Vargas has approached riders in the past, and he's actively encouraging it.
Well, he's been central to the story since it first appeared in 2010 with Fabien Cancellara, and the rumours then that he had used a motor in winning Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. Those were the rumours that led to the first bike checks at the 2010 Tour de France. And one can't help think that he has a vested interest in the story, and a financial interest in the story, doesn't he? All the publicity around it will be doing him no harm at all.
Yeah, and he is becoming more and more central. He's appearing in more and more TV programs. He's done several interviews now. He did an interview with Italian TV earlier this year in which he talked about the possibility of, I mean, it sounds comical, but director sportif sort of mechanics controlling these motorized wheels from a team car and effectively pressing a button, or pressing a button on watches, or heart rate monitors. And there was a link made in the Stade d'Or programme with some slightly odd footage, a curious shot of Alberto Contador's mechanic, Faustino Munoz, after a stage of the Giro d'Italia last year, the Giro d'Italia that Contador won. And Faustino Munoz was waiting for Contador's bike to be checked by the UCI. He was sort of fiddling with his watch strap in a very curious way. But again, it almost seems as though Vargas is encouraging and sort of fostering some of these rumours. And again, it's all done with a bit of a glint in his eye.
I mean, I made this point to Rob earlier chatting about it, how that was curious behaviour. But if you had a camera on any of us at a bike race, we'd all be guilty of curious behaviour at times, I think. You know, we all act oddly at times.
I was going to ask you, chaps, what you thought of that, because that was by far and away the most bizarre part of the documentary the other day. And again, it's not It's not hard evidence, it's circumstantial, not even approaching, maybe, circumstantial evidence. It's very, very strange, but what exactly is he doing there?
Well, why don't you ask him? If you're a journalist doing an investigation, exactly. Why don't you go and ask him? That was the... There was very little right reply. We should be asking him. We will ask him. I mean, we're just going to really touch on this today. We've gone on a bit too long, but we want to do this subject properly because we are reacting to stuff that's been in the media this week and to some of the reaction. We need to get out there, and it's something that we've spoken, all of us, to mechanics and writers about the last few years. We spoke about it last year. We did a Kilometre Zero, actually, on the mechanics at the Tour de France last year, and I asked Chris Froome's mechanic, for example, about it. He said he was too busy to worry about a motor, but it's something we've been talking about for years now, but... As you say, Daniel, you know, if there's a ticking time bomb, we need to get out there and really revisit this subject.
And if we remove ourselves for a second from the moral implications of this and how devastating it could be for the sport, it's an absolutely titillating, fascinating whodunit. I mean, when we think back to last year's Giro d'Italia and we think about the rumours then, and then we think about the stage. When the riders went at the Mortirolo and there was a bike change before the Mortirolo, supposedly because Contador had a puncture, he changed wheels with Ivan Basso. Then Oleg Tinkov, his team owner, posted a picture on Twitter of the wheel that had been, or the tyre that had been punctured, with a big nail stuck right in the middle of the wheel in a way that you wouldn't usually expect to see for a punctured tyre. And you know, you can put all of these elements together and it does become like...
I'm not sure about that, Daniel. I think, you know, you've been golfing a lot recently. I think if you ride over a nail can stick in a tyre in any way.
What, sticking an inch out of the tyre?
Possibly, anything's possible.
You're correct to pour a lot of cold water and caution over this for now, but I think it is certainly a subject that does need investigating and one that we can't just brush under the carpet, I think. There are a lot of very, very strange... For those of you who maybe don't speak French as well or couldn't get access to the documentary, bike changes seem to be a big recurring thing as well. So there are a lot of questions to be asked, a lot of questions to be answered. But again, I don't think anybody should look at this and say, oh, well, it's definitely happening. This is... And they've done it.
The problem with it is that... You know, so anyone who's doing it is taking a huge, huge, huge risk because you can't explain it away like biological doping. You can't argue that it accidentally got into your bike. On the other hand, if you do it and you get away with it, you've got away with it forever. There's no freezing of samples or going back and retrospectively testing. So there are these two elements to it. You take a huge, huge, huge risk. It's a massive gamble. Professional athletes, a lot of them are huge gamblers anyway. So I think we keep our minds open.
And I would be much more suspicious if the riders we were talking about, and let's not forget the main riders who have been incriminated, linked to this story, have been Fabian Cancellara, Alberto Contador, and to a lesser extent, Chris Froome. I would be a lot more suspicious if we were talking about what the Italians call meteorites, i.e. riders who soar 1 minute and have incredible results and then disappear without trace. We're talking about riders who have had incredible results for 10, 15 years.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by sigmasport.co.uk, the UK's leading road cycling store. Use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout to receive £10 off your next order of £50 or more.
Okay, you heard there our extended jingle for sigmasport.co.uk, the home of road cycling. Thank you very much to them. They're sponsoring us throughout April. Just give you a little bit of background on Sigma Sport. For those not familiar, the huge shop in Kingston is an Aladdin's Cave. If Aladdin's Cave was 6,000 square feet full of gleaming road bikes, equipment and clothing, Rob's eyes are widening here, plus another 3,000 square feet of workshop space, bike fit and treatment room. It is an incredible place. That opened in 2010. But the business started in 1991 when Jason Turner and Ian Whittingham began bringing bikes and parts back from Belgium, selling them from a spare bedroom and advertising in Cycling Weekly. They opened their first shop in 1992 and were always focused on road cycling, a bit like us. 3 years ago, they started the mail order business, and that has just overtaken the store as the largest revenue stream. They employ 80 people now and have a big warehouse in Surrey where customers are welcome. But they are a business that put something back into the sport, sponsoring clubs, women's teams, events, and even a young Bradley Wiggins. The Olympic time trial passed their front door in 2012, and in his autobiography, Wiggins said the loudest cheers of the day emanated from the shop. It's important to remember that Sigma Sport are not a big conglomerate, multinational, what's it? They are an independent bike shop, albeit now a very big one, still run by Jason and Ian. So do give them your business and tell them that you heard about them through the Cycling Podcast. Remember to add the code PODCAST10 for your £10 discount with your next purchase. And, you know, it's been really nice having a relationship with them. A lot of their customers seem to be listeners to the podcast as well, and hopefully we can help them find new customers. They are very good independent bike shop. Daniel.
We've had a relationship with Sigma Sport. We've had self-massage with Wellbricks. It's taken an alarming twist, this podcast, this week.
Well, the massage brick seems to have disappeared from my lower back, where apparently my ego is placed as well. But it's been very nice. Tell us about the Kilometre Zeros coming up, Daniel.
We have, hopefully, already gone out. We have a Monday after Hell, day after Paris-Roubaix. We also have going out later this week a giant struggle, which is the story of Giant Alpecin's efforts to recover from the terrible accident that struck their team at Calpe at their training camp earlier this year. It's been a bit of a tough spring for that team, but they're on the road to recovery, certainly.
And those 4 kilometre zeros, the final one will be a report from Flesh Alone. I'm heading to Flesh Alone to spend a day with Canyon SRAM, Hannah Barnes on the comeback trail, and our final Kilometre Zero from the Spring Classics will be from there, and that'll be out in a couple of weeks. And they're sponsored by Wellbricks, the massage bricks. Look them up, wellbricks.com. Thank you to them as well. So we're going to talk in this not quite final part, because we'll come back to plug our friends special, our forthcoming friends special in the final bit. But we're just going to touch on the disc brake debate as well, because again, we'll hear from Brent Copeland on that, who's got a sort of vested interest in the story, Lamprey having been one of the teams using disc brakes. But Daniel, can you just sort of fill us in with where we are on the disc brake story and controversy?
There have been murmurs throughout the spring, or throughout the early part of this year, murmurs of discontent about the UCI having given the green light for certain teams to trial disc brakes, and Lamprey Merida were one of the teams that decided they wanted to use disc brakes in the Spring Classics. Direct Energy, the French team, are another one. There have been concerns about the safety of disc brakes. Now, disc brakes are obviously something that has been introduced, or there's been a clamour for them to be introduced, because they supposedly make braking safer and they should lead to fewer crashes in the peloton in theory. However, the flip side to that is that the mechanism for disc brakes is effectively a rotor, and it's a blade, and it's an exposed blade, and various riders have worried that it could be a hazard and it could cause accidents, make accidents worse, if open flesh was to strike the blade itself. Fran Ventoso, the Movistar rider at Paris-Roubaix, had a nasty crash. We didn't know that much about the crash at the time. However, 3 days later, Fran Ventoso took to social media, took to Facebook to write an open letter outlining the circumstances of the crash, and in particular stating that disc brakes were to blame for terrible injuries on his left leg. And within 24 hours, to give them some credit in this, the UCI had reacted and they had suspended the trials of disc brakes and told Lamprey Marie that they could no longer use them, told Direct Energy they could no longer use them. Almost instantly, well, within a few hours, Brent Copeland, the Lamprey Merida general manager, he'd got in contact with me, and he'd wondered aloud, really, about the circumstances of Ventoso's crash. Brent had also made inquiries. He'd asked all of his riders who were at Paris-Roubaix whether they could have been the rider, theirs could have been the bikes, theirs could have been the disc that caused Ventoso's accident. That wasn't the case, so it must have been a Direct Energy rider. And Brent really also wanted to talk to me about the issues that have arisen in the last week and the rights and wrongs of the UCI suspending these trials, what the UCI perhaps should have done prior to giving the green light for these trials.
I was in the hospital when Ventoso came in. Our rider Federico Zullo crashed about 10 kilometers before the accident of Ventoso. I was in the team car, I jumped out, and the accident looked worse than what it was. Fortunately, no riders was Ventoso, the other one was the Ethics rider Mice, and the Orica rider as well. So yeah, the hospital was pretty full with all the accidents from Roubaix, unfortunately.
And you spoke to Ventoso, didn't you? And he said to you immediately, did he, that he thought that the cuts and the wounds had been caused by a disc?
Yeah, that's right. As soon as he got there, him and the Ethics rider both said, you know, look at us, we've been cut by discs. And I had a close-up look at the cut that happened to his leg. It was unfortunately a really bad deep cut, which I'm sure everyone's seen pictures of. At first, I felt terribly responsible because obviously being one of the teams with discs. Then we spent about 4 hours in the hospital, and I spoke a lot to him and to Mace. And the more I looked at the cut and the more I thought about the accident, it didn't quite make 100% sense to me. I couldn't see the practical way of how a cut like that could happen on his left leg, on the upper part of his shin. And the more we discussed it, the more I spoke to him about it, we couldn't come out with the logical, or I couldn't come out with the logical answer to how it happened.
And the issue of the exposed discs and them being effectively a blade and being dangerous, I mean, you were aware of this, Brent, I know, because you have a background of working in, well, motorcycle racing, MotoGP, and disc brakes are something that have existed there for a long time. But were your riders worried about this, and had riders from other teams not using discs already expressed their concerns to you and to your team about disc brakes being in the peloton and the risk that they could expose to them?
For sure there's been concern. I think anything new always brings about a bit of concern. Anything new is always a risk for the riders and for the teams. So I think there was definitely a lot of concern. Our main objective when starting this project was obviously safety for our riders. You know, our riders are our main assets of the team, and we go to the race with trying to have less risk of safety for the riders as possible. It's already so dangerous for them on the road in the races with so many uncontrolled circumstances that we try to get them on the start of the line with safety as the major factor. Yes, I've worked in MotoGP for a number of years. I'm no engineer, I'm no technical freak as far as that's concerned. What I can say from the experience in MotoGP is new technology is always being tested, obviously with safety being the major factor there as well. But, you know, the engineers and the manufacturers are working closely with the riders there as well, obviously trying new things continuously. And this should be happening in cycling like it's been happening in the last few years. And the disc brakes is part of this new technology which should be tested. I personally feel it's something for the future. The braking is definitely safer in wet conditions. Unfortunately, the rules and regulations of the UCI was that there didn't have to be a full protection. Now, I was one of the people in the beginning to say if we put these into the races, there should be a full protection. But until the UCI make it a rule, obviously the manufacturers go ahead with the manufacturing of these products without making a full protection. Why? I cannot answer that. I guess it could be because of the heating up of the blades. I'm not sure. I'm not an engineer. But now it's easy to look back and say, yes, a rider was presumably cut, and there should have been a protection on the blade. So the project has unfortunately been stopped. Being stopped as far as testing in races is concerned. When that will be changed, I'm not sure. I can confirm that together with Merida, we're working on a way to make the product as safe as possible. And we'd like as much information as possible from this accident to improve that product.
And just for the record, I mean, Ventoso did say that it was a Direct Energy rider that he thought he'd crashed into. There were a couple of your riders in that group with Ventoso, weren't there? But they were not, well, they were certainly not the causes of the crash or the injuries. I think you've spoken to both of those riders and they have ruled it out.
From our side, there was definitely no one involved in that accident. On Direct Energy side, I'm not sure. I don't know if anyone's tried to contact them or who's gone out of their way to find this rider, but for me, this would be the most logical way of finding out the proof and the facts of the accident. I know Chalanel was in the break, so that leaves maximum seven riders. Out of those seven, I don't know how many Direct Energy had in the group at the time, but you know, it doesn't take much to phone these riders or phone the manager of the team to find out exactly who the rider was. Let's get as much information from him as possible in order to make the product better for the future. This is my point of the accident. You know, we've got to obviously take the best out of it that we can. It's a real pity that Ventoso's cut so badly. We're all sorry for that. And like I said, I felt responsible for this to a certain extent because I let our riders ride on the discs, but at the same time, I want proof that it was actually that.
So we heard there from Brent Copeland. Obviously, as I said earlier, he has a vested interest in this. Very keen to see disc brakes adopted. There's, you know, the sponsor at Lampre Merida are obviously keen for them to be developed and accepted. Rob, I think you had something to say on that as well.
I just want to echo Daniel's sentiments from right at the start of the piece when he said, "Well, for once, let's give the UCI a bit of credit for acting quickly on this." I mean, we criticise them, and quite rightly, when they've made all manner of cock-ups in the past. Let's say, well done for suspending the trial straight away whilst we investigate this thing. Do we really need them in the peloton? I know people say that it makes braking better, safer, but it certainly doesn't make braking safer if half the riders or a number of riders are on them and the rest aren't, because you've got all sorts of people mixed up braking at the same time, braking with different power and different speed. And one thing I noticed from the early part of the season, we had one team declare for disc brakes. That was Rompot Oranje Peloton, but their star rider was still on calipers, and that was Peter Weining to Volta Catalunya. He was the only man riding them. So there are people, as you suggested, Daniel, in the peloton who aren't happy with this. And I think you made a great point on Twitter last week. This is the bit where everybody gets a say, but even if you aren't part of the decision that's made, you're still affected by it because you could be caught up in a crash and made a right mess of, like we've seen with Fran Mendoza and Nicolas Mars, who was also injured.
I could do without seeing those pictures again. I could have done without seeing them quite as many times as I did see them on social media.
I did say that the UCI deserves some credit. However, that there is a suspicion here that they have shut the stable door after the horse was bolted, in the sense that, and Brent, to be fair to him, does make the point that the UCI were aware of the concerns, they were aware of the Riders Association's concerns, the Teams Association's concerns, and perhaps they shouldn't have given the green light for these trials to go ahead. And they certainly, if they were going to allow teams to adopt disc brakes, they should have taken into consideration what the riders were saying and teams were saying about the need for a shield over these disc brakes. And I think that is what we will eventually end up with. We will end up with disc brakes in the peloton, but there will be some kind of plastic shield, or I mean, Brent said himself he doesn't know exactly what form that would take, and probably rounded blades on the discs themselves so they pose less of a risk. However, as it stands, it doesn't take a genius or an engineer to work out that 400 extra exposed blades in the peloton, because the average peloton around 200 riders or 150 riders times two for each wheel, it is a hazard, and it's a greater hazard than chain rings. I mean, equipment manufacturers, I remember a conversation we had with Scott Jackson of Specialized last year. He said, well, you know, chain rings are dangerous. There are a lot of guys with scars from chain rings in the peloton. However, it's a blunter instrument than a hot disc on the front and a back wheel of a bike.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's used disc brakes on a mountain bike, they are better. So it seems that, you know, progress will take us towards disc brakes. It doesn't seem to me that you can have some riders on discs and some not on discs. So I don't know how the transition is managed, if at all. And I was surprised at just how polarised this debate was and how impassioned people were on each side. And as with so many debates, I find myself seeing both sides and in a wishy-washy way coming down somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I can see both sides. I'd still yet to hear a convincing argument why we really need them in professional bike racing.
Because they're better.
they're better, but will that not lead to people rushing into corners more, ending up off the side of mountain tops, speeds, people being a bit less careful about going into corners and descents in particular, into sprint finishes taking corners? Will they not?
I don't think so.
Natural caution doing that.
I don't really buy that argument. I mean, I think people made a similar point when they introduced helmets, that people would take more risks with wearing helmets. I don't think that stands up, and I don't think that it's a reason not to go with better technology. And there's no doubt that disc brakes are a superior form of braking.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
As with motors and bikes, we will return to the disc brake controversy at some point. We're going to be joined by our good friend Kayleigh Fretz at some point over the next few weeks, and at the Tour de France as well. He's going to the Giro. Kayleigh, who works for Fellow News, is a bit of an equipment guru, and he knows far more about this stuff than we do, so we'll be tapping into Kayleigh's expertise, and I'm sure he can shed more light on these topics. Coming up this week, as well as the Wellbrix Kilometre Zeros, we have our next friend special, and that is a trip to Nice that I took at the invitation of Ian Boswell of Team Sky. I spent a day with him, Joe Dombrowski, Larry Warbass, as they went out training and then sat and chatted in Café du Cycliste in Nice. And it was fascinating that they are three of the most intelligent, I think, eloquent riders, all very promising young riders, very talented. And they've got really interesting insights and things to say. So I hope you enjoy that. That should be available on Friday. If you're not already a friend of the podcast, sign up for £10 for the year at www.thecyclingpodcast.com. And thank you very much to everybody who has signed up. We will also be releasing details of all our forthcoming Friends specials very soon. Let's just hear a little clip from the Friends special in Nice with the young Americans. Just a couple of minutes here of first Joe Dombrowski, then we hear from Ian Boswell and Larry Warbass.
Cycling, people don't see this. Like, my mom told me once that she loves watching the Tour de France for the scenery, but also the way the peloton moves down the road because it's like a flock of birds. And I was like, if the peloton moved down the road like a flock of birds, then my life would be a whole lot easier. Because it's just a big shit fight, you know, to be honest.
It looks very serene from a distance, but up close, it's chaotic.
Elbows out, yeah. And I think even my personality, I'm pretty lighthearted and not, you know, very aggressive. And sometimes that shows even on the bike, when I need to be a bit more aggressive. So I think...
Is it a nice place, the peloton?
No, it's not nice at all. I wouldn't say. I mean, wouldn't you guys say it's quite cutthroat?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing, my first year on Sky, I was doing Paris-Nice, and I think the first day I was just at the back all day. It was windy, crosswind, I crashed. And I was rooming with Joe's teammate, Alex Howes, another American. And he's kind of a eccentric character. He's typical Garmin or Cannondale rider. And he just said, Ian, you got to f*** them before they f*** you. And that was just his advice. And then he just walked away. And I think that's true in the world tour. I think, you know, we're friends. Even, you know, someone, Larry and Joe, they're my friends. We train together. But in a race, there's times when you just have to look away.
Ian's eyes narrowed there.
Yeah, I think, you really have to fight. And you really see how difficult it is, not only physically but mentally, when you're in a race like a grand tour. You know, you hear all these people in these grand tours say, like, they almost have like a list of guys that they hate, and let's hope I'm not on the top of that, but you know, a lot of them are usually common guys, but it's like you almost are, even if you don't even speak with these guys, you're like fighting with them in your head, you know, because this guy's chopping you there or there, and you talk about it at the dinner table like, and you know, it really, it's not an easy place to be. And I think it takes a lot of mental energy just to even ride around in the bunch, which I think that's one of the things that makes a difference.
I'll tell you, it's the same on every single team bus after every single stage in a grand tour. Everyone gets on the bus and we all bitch about all the other riders in the peloton and what they did and, you know, who did this and who did that.
Okay, that was a tantalising little extract from the Friends special. Covered a lot of ground, the lads in Nice, the American boys. thank you very much to them. And I think we're going to wrap it up for this week with a promise to return to these thorny topics in the future. And next week we'll be talking, of course, about the Ardennes Classics, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, as well as other races and issues. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.